The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Hello, this is Greg Cockcroft from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is The Atlantic. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from The Atlantic magazine. Our first article today is entitled, The Real Problem with the FAA. There's a fundamental flaw in the way the United States guides airplanes around the country. And this was written by Dorothy Robin. The ongoing crisis at Newark Liberty International Airport has laid bare the sorry state of our nation's air traffic control system. Equipment outages have left air traffic controllers unable to track or communicate with planes for multiple 30 to 90 second intervals. Some controllers have had to take leave to recover from the trauma, exacerbating a staff shortage and forcing the Federal Aviation Administration to further curb flights at Newark. The Newark crisis comes soon after January's deadly mid-air collision over Ronald Reagan Washington National Airport, in which air traffic control may have been a factor. In 2023, a malfunction of the FAA's safety notification system for pilots forced the agency to ground all flights nationwide for the first time since 9/11. A post-COVID surge in near collisions, due in part to controller shortages and the dearth of preventive technology on airport runways, raised even greater alarms. A high-level safety panel convened in response to the string of near collisions painted a dire picture of deteriorating ATC facilities and legacy ATC systems, many of which are so old that the FAA can no longer obtain spare parts. The Trump administration has doubled down on Biden administration efforts to attract and retain controllers, and Transportation Secretary Sean Duffy, a former representative from Wisconsin and reality TV star, recently called for investing tens of billions of dollars, the exact cost is unclear, to build a brand new air traffic control system over the next 3 years. At an April 8th press conference in which Donald Trump participated by phone, Duffy, surrounded by a phalanx of airline CEOs, union leaders, and trade association executives, urged Congress to fully fund the project upfront and to streamline permitting requirements to accelerate construction of new facilities. To be sure, throwing money at the problem has some merit, given the dire condition of the ATC system. The FAA's capital budget has gone down both in real terms and as a share of agency spending over the past 20 years, as the cost of operating a creaky ATC system has consumed ever more resources. Moreover, according to congressional testimony from Paul Rinaldi, the former head of the Air Traffic Controllers Union, fully 92% of the FAA capital budget is devoted to maintaining legacy systems rather than funding new technology. However, the Trump-Duffy proposal is flawed in a host of ways, the most egregious of which is that it preserves the current ATC governance structure. Blue Ribbon commissions and independent experts have long argued that this structure is the underlying source of our nation's ATC problems. Simply stated, air traffic control is a 24/7 high-tech operation trapped inside a regulatory agency. The FAA is bound by stultifying federal rules and sees Congress, not the traveling public, as its customer. Air traffic control is not inherently a governmental function. Keeping planes safely separated is a complex but purely operational process that follows well-established rules. Like running an airline or manufacturing a commercial aircraft, air traffic control can be performed by a non-governmental entity as long as it is overseen by safety regulators, which perform a function that is inherently governmental. The most compelling evidence of this is that most developed countries have now corporatized their ATC provider. Precisely because of the operational nature of air traffic control, in fact, the federal government is poorly suited to run the system. Budget rules, for example, require federal agencies to pay for capital investments up front, out of current appropriations. These rules bar the FAA from financing large investments over time, as a normal business would. The resulting slow pace of FAA technology deployment means that new ATC systems might be obsolete by the time they are fully fielded. The FAA procurement culture is another constraint. Companies with transformational technologies struggle to gain traction in a stifling environment dominated by defense contractors and incentives for bespoke rather than off-the-shelf solutions. The FAA also suffers from political interference. The agency must maintain costly legacy systems in part to accommodate powerful users whose aircraft are not equipped to operate updated technology. And individual members of Congress routinely prevent the FAA from closing facilities it no longer needs, at a cost of hundreds of millions of dollars a year, and opening new ones it does need. Recently, Oklahoma lawmakers blocked legislation to authorize a second training academy for controllers for fear that it would pose a threat to the existing academy in Oklahoma City. Most important, the current governance arrangement jeopardizes safety because the FAA both operates and regulates the air traffic control system. This is a clear conflict of interest and one that the International Civil Aviation Organization has directed member countries to eliminate. Despite broad agreement on the problem, efforts to take air traffic control out of the FAA so it can operate like a public utility have repeatedly failed. In 2018, despite strong support from the Trump administration, the House of Representatives declined to take up legislation approved by the House Transportation and Infrastructure Committee that would have moved the ATC system to a self-supporting nonprofit corporation, leaving the FAA as an independent safety regulator. In 1995, the Clinton administration similarly tried and failed to transfer ATC to a nonprofit government corporation. The Clinton administration's 1995 bill to corporatize ATC was dead on arrival in Congress, primarily because of pushback from private pilots and corporate jet owners, who pay almost nothing to use the ATC system. The same dynamic played out in 2018. In addition to protecting private pilots, the House bill preserved the fee structure that shifts $1 billion or more a year in costs from one percenters in their $65 million Gulfstreams to the crowded passengers in coach. Skeptical that such largesse would continue under a privatized system, the Corporate Jet Trade Association, flying under the cover of a much larger private pilot lobby, persuaded Congress to keep air traffic control stuck in the previous century. The rest of the world moved in a very different direction. Whereas in 1995 only four countries had separated ATC from the aviation safety regulator, now more than 60 have done so, typically by creating an independent government corporation or other nonprofit provider. The Canadian ATC provider, NAV Canada, the model for the 2018 House bill, is handling significantly more traffic with a smaller staff than in 1996. It beats the FAA on unit costs despite its smaller scale. Scott McCartney, who wrote the Wall Street Journal's long-running middle seat column, observed in 2016 that flying south of over the U.S.-Canadian border is like time travel for pilots. You have to leave a modern air traffic control system run by a company and enter one run by the government struggling to catch up. As regrettable as it is, the crisis facing our nation's ATC system gives the Trump administration political leverage. The current proposal squanders that leverage, promising the aviation sector tens of billions of taxpayer dollars with no accompanying reform of the deeply flawed ATC governance structure. Reform that would have the support of all but a few of the aviation leaders that surrounded Duffy on April 8th. In the end, the promise of a sizable investment in ATC may be necessary to get a political deal, but without the quid pro quo of structural reform, more funding won't solve the underlying crisis. Our second story is The Two Choices That Keep a Midlife Crisis at Bay by Arthur C. Brooks. The dirty secret of social scientists is that a lot of research is actually me-search. Many of us tend to study aspects of life that affect us personally, looking for solutions to our own issues. In that spirit, I celebrated my 58th birthday last week, not with a toupee or a red sports car, but rather by investigating how to have the best possible midlife crisis. The midlife crisis phenomena has taken on almost mythic proportions in the American psyche over the past century. The term was first coined by the Canadian psychoanalyst Elliot Jacques, who noticed a pattern in the lives of great men in history. Many of them lost productivity and even died in their mid to late 30s, which was midlife in past centuries. The idea entered the popular consciousness in the 1970s when the author Gail Sheehy wrote her mega bestseller, Passages, Predictable Crises of Adult Life. Sheehy argued that around the age of 40, both men and women tend to descend into a crisis about getting old, running out of time to meet their goals, and questioning life choices. She based her work on in-depth case interviews with 115 individuals, the most famous of whom was the auto entrepreneur John DeLorean. He went on to become infamous in 1982 when, at the age of 57, he was arrested for attempting to sell about 60 pounds of cocaine to undercover federal agents. For years, scholars mostly didn't challenge the conventional wisdom that a traumatic midlife crisis was normal, if not inevitable. More recently, however, many have found that a crisis is not our unavoidable fate. Without knowledge and effort, you and I can make two crucial choices that can lead to harnessing the changes and difficulties of aging to instead design a midlife transcendence. The timing of midlife is very subjective. As the psychologist Daniel J. Levinson aptly defined it 30 years ago, and as others have since validated, middle age is when, quote, one is no longer young and yet not quite old, end quote. This leaves a lot of room for perception. In a 2000 survey by the National Council on Aging, nearly half of the respondents ages 65 and older considered themselves middle-aged, as did a third of Americans in their 70s. For me, 58 feels just about right. My life insurance company tells me that I can expect to live to 98, given my health and personal habits. I started my adult life at 19 when I left school and started working full-time. So the halfway point of adulthood for me is 58.5. Whether it becomes a crisis or not, midlife is indeed a difficult time for many. One common reason is what psychologists have called sandwiching. As you raise your kids, you are also saddled with the care of aging parents. According to findings from the 1995 National Survey of Families and Households, about 40% of people in their early 40s have both parents alive. About 80% of people in their late 60s have no parents alive. During the intervening years, adults spend an average of 2.5 hours a day in unpaid care of a family member. The burden of caregiving can even be more overwhelming for those with little time or limited financial resources. These challenges are compounded by a strange and very personal shift that starts around your 40s. The skills you honed in early adulthood start to wane. If you don't focus on the abilities that grow as you get older, you might perceive aging as an unmitigated loss, which will be a source of suffering. But you can work to avoid that fate by making two wise decisions about how you think about midlife. The first decision, choose to focus on what age gives you, not what it has taken away. The developmental psychologist Eric Erickson believed that midlife presents a crossroads of two paths forward, which he called generativity and stagnation. My own research bears this out and shows that the path you take is largely up to you. Stagnation, which can lead to crisis, happens when you try to fight against time, whether you're desperately trying not to look older or struggling against changes in your skills and strengths. Generativity comes from accepting your age and recognizing the new aptitudes and abilities that naturally develop after age 40 and get stronger through your 50s and 60s. These include the growing ability to see patterns clearly, teach others, and explain complex ideas, what psychologists call crystallized intelligence. The second decision, choose subtraction, not addition. Early in life, success usually comes from addition. More money, more responsibility, more relationships, more possessions. Life in early adulthood is like filling up an empty canvas. By midlife, however, that canvas is pretty full, and the more brush strokes make the painting worse, not better. This explains why studies find the most common concerns reported by middle-aged adults involve getting everything done in their busy life, their energy level, job complications, and insufficient sleep. Midlife is the point at which your medium of choice should change from a canvas to a sculpture, in which the work of art appears as a result of chipping away, not adding. This is hard to do when you have accepted a lot of responsibilities at work and at home, but I have found that in many cases, the most important impediment to chipping away is a belief that success equals more. In middle age, this is bad math. Work to change your objective by stepping away from voluntary duties and responsibilities, making more time to think, read, love, and pray. The work that you need to do to re-engineer you. You can take these steps on your own if you want, or get assistance from the growing number of organizations designed to help you along this path, such as entrepreneur Chip Conley's Modern Elder Academy, or my own university's Advanced Leadership Initiative, two programs I have personally participated in. But even if you do nothing at all, a terrible crisis is hardly inevitable, nor even especially likely for most people. Writing in the journal Motivation and Emotion in 2000, the Cornell sociologist Elaine Wethington found that 90% of Americans are familiar with the idea of the midlife crisis and describe it pretty accurately from a psychological standpoint. But only 15.5% of men and 13.3% of women reported suffering one. In fact, for most people, life gets better starting in middle age. Over the years, people tend to get happier, more creative, less neurotic, more agreeable, and more conscientious. On average, research suggests that people get steadily psychologically healthier after 30 and well into old age. Most likely, there will be no full-blown crisis, even if you let nature take its course. Pursuing generativity and subtraction will make the second half of your life that much better. Looking for joy in middle age might sound like putting lipstick on a pig, looking for a few scraps of happiness in an obviously unhappy period of life. But midlife is not a pig, unless you like pigs. And no lipstick is necessary. You will inevitably face hardships and challenges, just like at any other point in your life. But you make it the right choices. If you make it the right choices, midlife may be the best opportunity and biggest adventure you have had in decades. Third today, The New Spiritual Leader on Campus by Cornelia Powers. On May 24, 1961, the Yale University chaplain William Sloan Coffin, Jr., led a group of Freedom Riders on a 160-mile bus ride from Atlanta, Georgia, to Montgomery, Alabama, to protest segregation laws. The voyage and his subsequent arrest turned Coffin into a national figure in the fight for civil rights. Yet even as he made headlines, Coffin remained committed to another, quieter aspect of his role as a college chaplain. Over the course of his 18 years at Yale, he spent virtually every afternoon counseling students. They discussed relationships, academic worries, theological questions, and, for those eligible, the prospect of being drafted into the Vietnam War. A priest first and foremost, he considered it a great privilege to enter what he called the secret garden of another person's soul. Today, at a moment when young people are much less likely to say they're religious, you might think that the demand for college chaplains would be on the decline. But recent evidence suggests the opposite is true. Although a 2022 report from the Public Religion Research Institute found that nearly 40% of young adults do not identify with any established religion, college students are actually attending religious life programs in larger numbers than they have in decades. And many colleges and universities have more chaplains, some volunteer and some paid, than they did in the early 2000s. James W. Frazier, a professor emeritus of history and education at New York University and the author of the forthcoming book Religion and the American University, told me, "Many of these chaplains are taking inspiration from Coffin. They're reimagining what a spiritual leader can be in order to better meet the needs and beliefs of their students, many of whom, religious or not, still crave a sense of belonging, meaning, and purpose. For years, religion was central to the American university life. Many colleges were established as divinity schools and led by presidents who doubled as ordained ministers." John Schmaltzbauer, a religious studies professor at Missouri State University who studies chaplaincy and campus ministry, told me, "But in the early 20th century, a great number of those institutions began shifting their focus from ministry to research, and college presidents started to devote less of their time to spiritual life. In their place, universities hired chaplains to preside over daily chapel services and offer moral guidance to students. The shape of the college chaplaincy transformed multiple times over the next several decades, first during the Coffin era, when it became a platform from which to advocate for social justice. Then again in the 70s and 80s, when social movements of the 60s lost steam, academic communities became significantly less religious, and the college chaplaincy shed some of its previous status. Modern college chaplains, deans, and directors of religious life have taken on a new grab bag of duties. In addition to leading forms of worship and talking with students about their faith, as they always have, many chaplains also help students navigate housing insecurity, safety threats, and campus protests. Although the position was once thought of as kind of a defined pot, Kristen Boswell, Elon University's chaplain and dean of multi-faith engagement, told me, it is now more of an interdisciplinary web. The chaplains themselves are also much more diverse. Whereas the chaplaincy was once dominated by white Christian men, many today are women or people of color, and they come from a range of religious traditions. Of the 471 chaplains recently surveyed by the Association for Chaplaincy and Spiritual Life in Higher Education, organization known as ACSLHE, the nation's largest membership organization for university chaplains, directors, and deans of religious and spiritual life, 6% say they don't identify with a major religion, and 2% said they don't believe in God at all. Chaplains' primary work is still counseling students, but many approach these conversations with more openness than their predecessors did. Reporting this story, I spoke with about a dozen college chaplains and campus ministry experts across the country, several of whom sit on the ACSLHE's board, citing their own experiences, which are backed up by a robust study body of research. They explained that most modern-day chaplains both engage in established religious practices and embrace alternative form of spirituality or self-care, which can be as varied as coloring sessions, friendship courses, and nature walks. Some students might see the religious center as a place where someone would try to convert them. Vanessa Gomez-Brake, the senior associate dean of religious life at the University of Southern California, and the first atheist humanist to occupy that position at a major American university, told me. But chaplains today tend to draw from a range of texts and traditions rather than proselytizing their own beliefs. Perhaps because of students' lack of exposure, contemporary college chaplains say they have never felt more needed. Schmalzbauer of Missouri State told me, having devoted their lives to service and existential inquiry, chaplains can be well positioned to advise religious devotees, the spiritually curious, or just average young person beset by angst. Their guidance might help undergrads as they sort through any number of uncertainties, whether about God, school, friendships, romance, family, or their undecided futures. Students will need someone who will hear them, who will sit with them, who will be present with them, and won't be on their phones in front of them. Nathan Albert, board president of ACSLHE and chaplain of the University of Lynchburg, told me, universities aren't blind to the pressure students are under, and many have made student wellness a priority. But crucially, as Schmalzbauer explained, pastoral care is not the same thing as psychological counseling. Chaplains can occasionally end up in tough spots, particularly as demand for mental health care has outpaced the supply of therapists and psychiatrists on college campuses. He also meets with some students experiencing depression and suicidal ideation. For these more serious cases, they work closely with the university's mental health center and even walk students to a counselor's door themselves. This isn't to say that chaplains don't have a role to play in improving student health and well-being. In recent years, some schools have paired chaplains with therapists and counselors to provide preventative mental health care. Wendy Cage, president of Bryn Mawr College and founder of the Chaplaincy Innovations Lab, told me, yet, unlike mental health professionals, the chaplain's goal is not to treat students, but rather to help them find community, meaning, and reprieve from the grind. People want to feel loved for who they are and not what they do. In a world where so much may not seem okay, college chaplains say they can help students, not via certainty or quick fixes, but as Coffin once said, by tending to their inner lives. The last article was edited slightly due to time constraints, as we have run out of time for today's episode of The Atlantic. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Greg Cockcroft, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The Atlantic is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.